Philema Coast to Coast, show number 6, June 10th, 2005. Thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Philema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow. Today's show is packed with information, so my part will be short. First, we have an interview with Marlene Cornelius about a new Thelemic temple opened in the Bay Area in California. This is an interesting experiment from three OTO members who decided to bypass their local political morass and take matters into their own hands. Next, we have an interview with Gerald Del Campo regarding the Order of Thelemic Knights. He discusses what makes the Order of Thelemic Knights different and why someone should want to join. Lastly, we have a 25-minute interview with Keith418 about what the Thelemic community is and is not creating and how the Thelemic community and the leaders look when compared to Quakerism. We will end the podcast with the music from the band Nuit. With all that said, let's get right into the interview with Marlene and find out about the exciting work being done at Pax Templi.
We have on the phone with us Marlene Cornelius from Pax Templi in California. Hi, Marlene. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, John?
Doing good. For those who don't know, just give a brief introduction. You're an OTO member in the Southern California area.
We're in Northern California.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We're in the Bay Area.
Okay, I'm sorry. In the Northern California area, who, although involved with the local body, you and a few other OTO members have gone out and founded a Thelemic temple, an independent Thelemic temple called Pax Templi.
Mm-hmm.
And you all are performing Mass and will be having classes and other Thelemic functions at it. And I wanted to ask you to come on to the podcast so that we could talk about the temple, what your motivations for creating the temple, how you did it, and hopefully, you know, this could be some inspiration for other people within or without organizations to go forward and kind of recreate this model in their local environment. So let's first start with why, or actually, who are the founders of Pax Templi?
Well, we have basically three members of the Order of Templarians that are out here, and we consider ourselves the principals of Pax Templi. That'd be myself, Kat Sanborn, and Chris Grabakevich. We're all current members of the OTO. Most are involved or have been involved in local bodies for years, but we've never successfully in the Bay Area had a standalone temple space separate from residential. And we just got together and decided that we wanted this thing, and we were going to manifest it and make it happen.
When did you decide to do this?
Well, it happened really quickly, actually. We'd been talking about it for maybe a couple months, but it was March 12th. We had gotten together to do a Mass on Zabi Egusopisis, which was being held over in Kat's house. And prior to the Mass, Chris, Kat, and I, we were the principals of the Mass, decided to focus the energy of that Mass toward a Thelemic Renaissance in the area and with the idea of manifesting a separate space that would be a neutral space for Thelema and other occult pursuits. We did the Mass on a Saturday, on Tuesday.
So you're saying it literally, you found the space within days of doing the Mass?
We found the space within 2.5 days of determining that we were going to do so.
Well,
they found us. You know, technically, it's not the space we have now. We found one space first, which was like 90% good for what we wanted. But then within another 3 weeks, we found the space we actually have.
Okay. And how has the community responded to the creation of the temple?
The community has had an overwhelming response of positiveness. I was simply amazed. I knew that it was time. I knew that there was enough variety of people who wanted to do something in the area to support it. That's the big experiment, you know, can we support this thing? But gave people 8 days' notice and had our opening party. No one knew about it besides Chris and I. Now, the local leadership of the lodge knew ahead of time, but, you know, basically it was just our plan, and we found the space, we got it, we announced it, and 30 people showed up.
Excellent. And there's no contention or problems with the OTO body. This isn't any kind of competition or anything of that nature, correct?
We do not intend to have any competition or negativity. There are some people who immediately react in a negative, and we're addressing that and dealing with that as it happens. This is not about the OTO. Kat, Chris, and I are all committed OTO members. You know, we do the OTO trip correctly. But PAX Temple is something that is larger than that. We want it to be an umbrella space where people from a variety of disciplines will feel welcome and able to come and just share in community and like-minded individuals.
Okay. The whole program of PAX Templi, doing Thelemic functions, what kind of events will be taking place at PAX Templi?
Well, we've already decided that we will be offering at least 2 Gnostic Masses a month. we are not a chartered body, so that limits OTO events other than doing the Gnostic Mass. Out of the 3 of us, Chris and I are both ordained already as priest and priestess, and Kat will probably be ordained within the near future. She's at that level. You know, so that's the only thing that we can portray OTO by. However, in the past, we've all worked very successfully with a wide variety of bodies here. In fact, you know, we're active at 418 in Sacramento, as well as Thelema Lodge locally and Mons Abbey Agnes Oasis. So, you know, we're not exclusionary. We're welcome to have events for actual bodies in our space. But beyond that, in order to actually support a standalone space, we realize that we need to reach larger than just any single organization. And so PAX Templi will be that kind of an umbrella situation where, you know, if Mons Abbey Agnes wants to host Mass in the Bay Area, because they're up in Marin, then they're welcome to use the space. And consequently, 418 and Thelema Lodge are more than welcome to use the space. With that in mind, we're not limiting the space to OTO activities either. So, you know, a lot of OTO bodies have various classes and offerings with things that are related but are not necessarily OTOs, but they're still Thelemic. And so we're hosting that as well. If anybody has ideas of what they want to do, there's a couple of people who are already coming up with proposals, quite elaborate, for things that they would like to do and offer, and I'm really excited about that.
If somebody was not involved in the OTO at all, but was involved with Thelema, would that still be an option for them to use the space for something such as yoga classes, tarot, astrology, or any number of other kinds of workings, Enochian, Goetic, so forth?
That is our vision right now. At this time, our mission statement has been posted, and it's like, as long as it's not antithetical to Thelema or the OTO, because we are OTO members, we have no problem with allowing other groups even, be they Golden Dawn, be they various other kinds of groups in the area, to use the space. I know there's a lot of Wiccan activity here. The Bay Area is really an occult center. There's so many different things going on that I think the words PAX Templi mean it's for everyone. You know, the only limitation will be based upon their own behavior as to whether or not, you know, people are welcome or not welcome to host events. UNPAC simply itself hosts events that will be, you know, in line with order regulations because we are order members, but I don't see any reason to limit it more than that. As long as it's Thelemic or God, I don't like the term, New Ionic, you know, who are we to say no, you know?
If a group wanted to take the Pax Templi model and create a temple in their local community, what steps should they consider doing, and how should they go about doing it, whether it's within or outside the OTO?
Well, the first thing that you need to do is you need to determine your commitment level. I mean, Kat and Chris and I spent the most of our time talking about how much are we willing to commit financially and time-wise, and for how long of a period to see whether or not this could actually become self-fulfilling, you know, continuous. So that would be the first thing. Find out who's interested and what your resources are. You need to scope out your area and find out what your rents are. Take a look at interesting options. You know, one of the things that we found and that worked for us, and in fact it's what we're doing right now, is Pax Templi is a 800-square-foot standalone space that is actually within a Bikram yoga center, but the room for Pax Templi is ours 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, ideally, we hope to outgrow this soon and have our own storefront or street access. We have a separate access. Everything's been really cool, but it would be really nice to, you know, move to something a little bit larger or more focal. Right now, we are a space within someone else's space, but it's standalone 24/7, so it's still a step up from doing something in someone's home.
What other considerations should people have regarding the community and manifesting this kind of temple?
Well, you know, one thing, like I say, is to assess your resources. For Pax Templi, we know that we have a large amount of actual OTO initiates in the area, but we looked to broaden it wider than that to other groups that we are friendly with and we know have a need for space occasionally. It's quite exciting, some of the larger picture of people who may or may not have a positive image of OTO are excited and interested in Pax Templi because it is not an OTO body, but it is a separate space opening up and offering to all. So if you have an area where there are other occult groups, you know, it would be to your advantage to scope out whether or not there's needs on their end also that you could help fulfill.
Okay. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast and making people aware of what the temple's doing. And if somebody was in the Bay Area or visiting the Bay Area, how could they contact Pax Templi to...
Well, we have a website of paxtempli.org. It's under construction, but soon that'll start being fleshed out. You could send an email to info@paxtempli.org, and you'll get a response through that. People can contact us as individuals and receive replies that way. You know, it's quite exciting to have seen such a positive response to what we're doing, considering it was like a very quick thing that we manifested. Right now, it's interesting to me. I want to see how it grows and develops myself. You know, right now, it's pretty much open-ended. I'd say have guidelines if you're going to try this, but don't be too restrictive at the beginning, see where it goes.
And if somebody wanted to contact you just to get information, and if they were interested in creating this something like this in their area, they can also email?
Yes. My email is mc156@yahoo.com. No, I'm sorry, mcornelius156@yahoo.com.
All right. I'll put that on the website. Mm-hmm. So people can go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website and click on that if they have any questions. Again,
okay.
I appreciate you being on the podcast and getting the word out. And if
okay.
there's anything else we could do, please let us know.
Sure, and I'll keep you appraised. You know, right now it's the courtship area. You know, people are contacting us. We're getting ideas. We're coming together with who wants to do what and how, and it's quite exciting.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Okay, John.
Bye-bye.
93.
Gerald Del Campo is a longtime member of the OTO, one of the founders of the Order of Thelemic Knights, and the author of two books called Nuion Magic, Thelema Without Tears, and Nuion English Kabbalah Revealed. Both books are published by Luxor Press and can be ordered from www.luxorpress.com. Del Campo is also a Gnostic bishop in the Thelemic Church of Alexandria and one of the original founders of the Thelemic community in Portland, Oregon. While there is much we could talk about on the podcast, today's interview is regarding the Order of Thelemic Knights. This is a relatively new group that sees chivalry as part of the Thelemic warrior path. While the group is not large, they are doing some interesting work, as you will hear about in the interview.
We have on the podcast with us Gerald O'Campbell from the Order of Thelemic Knights. You there, Gerald?
Yes, hi.
Hi, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So, to get going, can you explain how the Order of Thelemic Knights started, when it started, and then shift into what it's about and its initiations, its practices, things that people would need to know if they were interested in joining the Order?
Sure thing. In 1987, while I was living in California, a group of friends and myself began to study the Templar mysteries. We became enthralled, and we discovered that the legacy did not end with the death of de Molay and his men. Many Templar knights escaped persecution, as you probably know, and continued their careers as soldiers elsewhere. And it was at that time where the Order of Thelemic Knights became an idea that gave birth to the Order as it is today. In 1989, the Order was officially instituted and magically dedicated as a vehicle for the promulgation of the Law of Thelema via various charitable activities, while at the same time providing members with a means to achieve Gnosis through initiation, study, and lessons learned from various warrior traditions. We put a lot of emphasis on the study of comparative religion. In 2003, the Thelemic Gnostic Church of Alexandria was created, and it was at that time that the Order of Thelemic Knights received a proper charter via a fons honorum from its bishop. In a nutshell, we basically believe that everyone should have access to the Law of Thelema. It should be available to everyone because all of us are already its subjects. You can't escape that. It has become apparent to us that Thelema possesses a built-in mechanism which separates Thelemites from non-Thelemites. Thelemites would comply with the law and succeed. Others will not comply and fail on their own volition. So we don't really set ourselves up as judges to determine who should get the law and who shouldn't. We want to make sure everyone has an opportunity to preview it. The Order, on the other hand, is very selective. We have a particular understanding of the law, which we feel is life-enhancing for the individual and for the social unit where he or she exists. We also believe that the source of all suffering is ignorance with regards to one's true nature. So, basically, we want to make sure that people understand who they are and what their place is in the grand scheme of things. Gaining that knowledge is very hard work, as you know. It takes a lot of dedication and desire. And we believe that at least it has to be one of the most important things in a person's life, or it isn't likely to happen for them. We therefore only seek individuals that have already achieved some mastery over their bodies, minds, and emotions. We do this not because we're trying to be elitist, but because people without that sort of control require tremendous attention, which can be taxing on the Order's limited resources.
Now, you mentioned an inner order or initiatory system, mm-hmm. kind of separate from the church. Can you elaborate on the initiatory process, what's involved, the various degrees?
Sure. There are 3 outer degrees and 7 inner degrees. The 3 degrees, the outer degrees, correspond to the 3 grades in Liber Al, the squire, the knight, and the peer. These are preparatory degrees, and they correspond to the three triads on the tree of life. The squire degree is a place for evaluation. The candidate comes to us, we provide him or her with some work, and we observe them. They, because they are now within our circle, get to observe us. So it's a mutual observation position where they decide whether or not the order is for them, and we decide whether or not that person can thrive within the order. During the time that they are squires, they are assigned a knight. A knight is basically their mentor. If they have any problems with the work or experience some misunderstanding with the work, they can always go to the knight, and the knight can instruct them and help them along. The seven inner degrees correspond to the Sephirot, which are represented by the planets on the Tree of Life.
What is the relationship between the church and the order? If you join the order, are you a member of the church, or do you have to participate in the church, or are they two separate things entirely?
They are two separate things. Generally speaking, traditionally, for a chivalric order to exist, it has to receive a thing called a fons honorum from either a king of a country or a bishop of some church. Fons honorum literally means source of honor. The church provides the order with its charter, with its fons honorum, so that the church can actually make knights. Traditionally, without a fons honorum, an organization cannot make knights. The Thelemic Gnostic Church of Alexandria is a Thelemic church, but it provides spiritual services for Taoists, Jews, Muslims, whatever. Like I said, we emphasize a lot of our study in religious, comparative religion. We want to know where Thelema comes from. Crowley was very well studied in all the various religions, and we know that he took all of the good things that he could find in other religions and made them a part of Thelema. That's part of our work as well.
You earlier mentioned charity work. Can you expand on the types of charity work that the order does?
Sure. We do charity work for a couple of reasons. The best reason for us is that the individual grows. The individual is able to reach a certain place by doing that work. It's almost like a happy coincidence that other people benefit from the work that we do. Some of the things that we've done is we did a hair drive for an organization called Locks of Love, which basically they weave real human hair into wigs for children that have had chemotherapy or have other diseases where they lose all the hair on their head. We put together a list called Upward Spiral, which offers assistance with drug abuse. That is no longer active. We engaged in an aggressive AIDS and hepatitis C campaign in Portland, where we took it to the streets. We disseminated pamphlets to Portland street kids. Some of these pamphlets went to Kentucky. Others went to Canada, so we made a really good impact there. We did Walk a Mile in My Shoes, where we did a shoe drive for street kids that didn't have shoes. We've done many clothing drives for many of Portland's homeless charities, but our most successful one was the Lakota Indian Reservation drive, where we accumulated 800 pounds of clothing, books, and school supplies for the kids that live there. And I should probably mention that we owe Sekhemat Lodge from OTO and the Ecclesia Gnostica Catholica Hermetica a great deal of thanks for making that drive such a successful drive. The latest thing that we've done was to provide safe houses for battered women in southern Oregon with a bunch of kids' toys and clothing.
If somebody wanted to get in contact with the order, How would they do so, and at what level of attainment should they feel prepared to? At what level of attainment should they be at before contacting the order? You said that the order is somewhat exclusive and requires people to have some level of discipline or capabilities or attainment within their spiritual practice.
Sure.
Can you elaborate on that more, and then also tell the listeners how to get in touch with the Order of Thelemic Knights?
Absolutely. Basically, we're looking for people, you know, you have to have a sincere desire to put this sort of study in the forefront of your life. We're not really a social organization. So what we want are people that are serious about their study, that they have a high level of comprehension where they read, people with critical thinking skills, and people who are just willing to be sincere about this work. That's basically it. And I realize that since we're not everywhere at once, it is difficult for us to go out and find people to invite them into the order if they possess the right mettle. But you can contact us at www.thelemicknights.org, and on our website you will see contact information via email or regular post. And if anybody's interested, we can go from there.
What countries is the OTK operating in?
We have members in Greece, Spain, and Italy. We have had recent interest from Bosnia.
And the actual initiations that take place, where would they need to travel to should they wish to take initiation?
Presently we have two working preceptories. One is in Ashland, Oregon. The other one is forming and should be done with its formation by the end of the month in Portland. But look for a preceptory to open up in Europe, Spain to be specific.
Does somebody have to take initiation to start the work with the first degree, or is that an initiation that they take after the probationary period? Or?
Well, one of the things, because it's been so difficult, because there are so few of us to go around and invite people, one of the things that the Grand Triumvirate has recently decided is that anybody that wants to take the squire work can basically contact us, fill out the paperwork, the application, and we will send them the work to do. If they continue beyond that, they will have to show up to one of the preceptories to take initiation because it's impossible to move forward without it.
Okay. And again, if somebody wanted to contact the order, what website would they go to?
www.thelemicknights.org. or com or net, it doesn't matter. If you, whatever you type in there, it will redirect you to the right place.
Fantastic. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you, John, and I appreciate everything that you're doing.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Since the interviews with Keith 418 have become very popular, I see no need to introduce this one. We'll just go right into the discussion.
Good evening, Keith. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast again.
Thanks for having me.
So what's been on your mind lately?
Well, any number of things. I mean, one of the things I've been talking a lot about with people lately is the whole idea of production. You know, one of my friends points out that the magical work, you know, is work. The great work is work. I think Crowley says that very directly at one point, and C.F. Russell may have echoed it. But that people sort of don't seem to get this a lot of times in the Thelema community. And it's about production. It's about actually creating things that are substantial. You know, a friend of mine said it's books on the shelf. That's really, you know, part of what the great work is. It's producing things. And it's not necessarily books or writing. I mean, one of my, you know, main issues with the Thelema community is that not everyone has to be a great writer or a great poet or somebody exactly like Aleister Crowley to be a great Thelemite. You know, you can be a fantastic doctor and be a great Thelemite. Or, you know, you can be a great, you know, lawyer or a great, you know, politician even and be a great Thelemite. You don't have to be a writer in particular, but that you have to produce something substantial or, you know, it's just not going to happen. And this is the thing I think, you know, people really need to look at. You know, a lot of times critics of various characters in the Thelema community or, you know, people looking in on us in general, they say, you know, well, this person hasn't done this or this person has this problem. But ultimately, in the end, it's the people that are producing things, that are producing original work, that are, you know, creating a vibrant and important community. those are the people that are really going to win the day. Those are the people that history is going to remember. I mean, there were plenty of people while Aleister Crowley was alive who were nicer than he was. They were better secular humanists. They were more caring about the environment and about the other people around them. They were kinder to children and to animals than he was. You know, they were vegetarians and vegans. I mean, it would probably not be difficult to find any number of people who meet the secular humanist criteria of what a good person is, much more than Crowley. But we're not all talking about them and debating their work and on LJ communities fighting about them and their opinions. We don't really even know who they were because they didn't produce anything that's important to us on the level that Crowley did. So, you know, I think people need to start looking at the fact that the people who produced the sort of stuff that he did are the people that are important. And that's much more important in a lot of instances than how good and nice and sweet and ideal a person you are from a secular humanist perspective.
One of the interesting things that I find in Crowley, you know, kind of the Renaissance person that he was, is that he had his broad level of talents and then particular strengths. And some of those strengths were not translated or were not found in his students, and that caused conflict between him and his students. How do you think that is translating into the Thelemic community these days?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think that a lot of times people rightly feel that they should be themselves and not necessarily try to be Aleister Crowley. And I think that that's valuable, and I think that there's a conflict over orthodoxy which sort of occurs in this area, and it particularly affects certain of the AA schools, where if you're orthodox, then all your experiments and work are going to do is to ratify Crowley's material, which we already have, so you're redundant. If you do experiments and work that diverge radically from what Crowley was doing, then you're a heretic and you're unorthodox, and you violated the main tenets of that AA school and that community. So they're caught between a rock and a hard place. If they follow Crowley relentlessly, they're redundant because we already have Crowley and they're not going to top what he did. And if they don't follow him and don't do everything exactly with the results that he got and come up with different conclusions and different ideas, then they're heretics that violate their whole raison d'etre as orthodox people to begin with. So what are they going to do? And the result that you see, I think, in a lot of these AA schools is a sort of distancing where Crowley is seen as an ideal or he's put up on a pedestal in a sort of fetishistic, worshipful way. And the idea that actually practicing his stuff and producing material that's, you know, with it, especially new and original material, is threatening or a problem. Now, I want to counter that by saying that just because you produce work that's different from Crowley's doesn't mean it isn't total garbage. I mean, I think a lot of times people think that because their work is different from Crowley or diverges from it, that means it's better or deserves some sort of acclamation because it's different from Crowley. You can be different from Crowley and be an idiot. You know, you can disagree with Crowley and be a total worthless fool. Likewise, agreeing with him doesn't necessarily make you a genius either. So, you know, I think we have to look at this kind of conflict. And especially look at some of the people claiming to be, you know, the one and only true AA that could ever be, and say, what are you really producing that's substantial other than just a recapitulation of what Crowley has already done and said?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the one AA and all of that jazz. I would think that they're the ones who are the most ossified and exhibit no amount of ingenuity or creativity.
I don't think that they don't serve an important function. And I mean, I want to defend these people when they're right and look critically at them when they're wrong. And oftentimes, sticking to an orthodox line when it comes to this stuff is completely correct. The people who diverge away from an orthodox position are often not doing it because they've received a higher initiation or they have insight Crowley didn't have that's important. It's that they're lazy morons who don't understand the Crowley material and don't believe that their lack of understanding is important, and so they jettison it because it's too hard and because they don't get it. That doesn't earn them any points with me. I think the orthodox generally are on the right track when it comes to demanding real work and real application. The problem is that they're not really producing anything substantial other than keeping the books in print, which we all need. Let's give them credit for that.
You're absolutely right. But if you look at the progress of knowledge and of fields, it's always built on the shoulders of the previous. So
that's correct.
Everything was that was done before was learned, and then that is the basis in which new experimentation and new things are done. So the problem is if people do not learn that material, as you're saying, then they can't build on that knowledge. But then again, if they only learn that material and are not allowed to build on that knowledge, it still doesn't lead you anywhere new.
Yeah, it's stagnating. It's not going anywhere. I mean, I really don't think anybody expected this great AA that claims itself to be, you know, so amazingly superior to be as lame as it is when it comes from its own production. I mean, there's no original work that they're producing at all, that they're publishing, that they're showing what they've got. I mean, all they're showing is they have the wherewithal and the will to get Crowley's material together and keep it in print. And we should take off our hats and salute them for that, because most of their competition doesn't have their acts together enough to even do 1/100th of that. So let's give them some credit for that. But let's also say, hey, aren't you guys supposed to be producing new and original material? It's about production. What are they producing? And a lot of times these people, especially their sort of followers in the OTO, are publishing nothing of merit. I mean, look at Agape. Look at some of these OTO official publications. I mean, come on. You go back 10 years, 15 years ago, look at the local publications. Look at the national publications. Where is the great work in them? Where are the great essays, the thought-provoking articles, the really challenging, engaged examinations of the material and what it means? It's just not there. And that's pathetic. That's not what we expected. I mean, no one joined any magical fraternity and expected to be surrounded with people who produce the kind of essays and the kind of writing that we see in the Thelemic community, especially as superiors and people that are supposed to be setting an example. Now, why aren't they doing that? I mean, this is my question. If they're so committed and so involved in material and are entitled to these grades, you know, of respect and awe and you know, import, why aren't they reflecting that with serious engagement and work on the material? And I don't see that.
It almost seems there's an inverse relationship. The higher the grade or the initiatory degree of a person, the less they're producing.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I do think that you see burnout. You see people in the Men of Earth triad that are really, really enthusiastic. They're, you know, they think they can go far. They think the sky's the limit. And then over time, they kind of get worn down and beaten down. You know, a friend of mine pointed out that a lot of the people with talent get sucked into the organization's bureaucratic infrastructure, and they get burned out there. They get frustrated. They see how difficult it is to get anything accomplished, and they're sort of sapped of energy. And I think that this is a good point. And I mean, I've seen this happen to people. Again, I mean, what are you going to do about it? I mean, I always thought that the solution was to say, hey, look, let's really make the organization work. Let's hold people to high standards. Let's make the function of the organization work better. And it's been hard to do that. I mean, it's really, there's a whole bunch of other competing issues which keep that from happening. So, yeah, you know, I think that does happen. But there are people that have been involved in the organization for a long time that have gotten burned out. You know, I mean, what's his name? Somebody said to me, well, magic is a young man's game. You know, as you get older, it gets harder and harder to do.
That's a very interesting observation.
Well, yeah, it's not one I agree with, by the way. But I think that, you know, unless you get involved with magic early on, it's harder and harder to do as you get older.
Well, let's switch subjects here and start looking at the Thelemic community compared with something that's very divergent. You use the Quakers as a good contrast for the Thelemic community. Can you talk about that somewhat?
Well, I was raised as a Quaker, so it's a background that I have a lot of experience with. My mom's family were Quakers going way back to the days of William Penn in Pennsylvania. So it's sort of a community that I feel like I have a lot of experience with. My mom was the clerk of her meeting for many years. She's very involved in the Quaker meeting on every possible level. My dad, while a convert to Quakerism, nonetheless is an amazingly sincere Quaker, in my opinion, and very, very involved in his meeting. And consequently, I mean, this was the sort of level of religious involvement and attachment that I grew up with as an example. And let me be clear, I am not a Quaker, okay? I am not fond of the Quakers. I didn't like them as a kid. I left the Quaker Church as quickly as I could, pretty much. I find myself endlessly frustrated with them. I have zillions of complaints and critiques about them. But nonetheless, I mean, I think that, you know, they serve a really interesting comparison for the Thelemic community because they're very individualistically oriented. They don't have a hierarchy when it comes to spirituality. They believe that every human being is equal and that God speaks to everyone, or the possibility of having God speak to you directly exists for everybody. They believe the individual has to determine what God's message is for them. You know, they believe in individual revelation. They haven't got a lot of rules. They don't have any strict ceremonies. You know, most Quakers don't. There are Quakers with more programmed services, but I'm not at all familiar with them. You know, the Quakers I grew up with, you know, shied away from anything like that. And in addition, you know, their decision-making process as a corporate body is completely consensual. If one person doesn't agree with the idea or the plan, then it doesn't happen.
Oh, so it's 100% unanimous.
Yeah, it has to be 100% unanimous. So you look at their belief system and the way their system works, and their system reflects their belief system. I don't really think that's happening with the Thelemic community, and it's why I kind of use the Quakers as an example, because I think most people in the Thelemic community have a kind of Quaker belief system, but are trying to operate a Roman Catholic or, you know, hierarchical structure. And I think this conflict is something that is almost the defining conflict of the Thelemic community, and its chief contradiction and its problem is that the beliefs of most of the members and the structure of the organization don't match, and that conflict just creates endless problems. And you have people saying, oh, the OTO should be run along democratic lines, there needs to be democratic reforms, or you have people saying, well, you know, I think we should elect the body masters, for example, or you know, people reject the whole nature of the way the organization is structured. And they don't engage with their own beliefs and their own feelings, I think, deeply enough to sometimes see these contradictions. But they're very apparent. And no one would expect that a Quaker could run a Roman Catholic organization effectively, just like a real serious Catholic would be frustrated with the Quakers. And I think the OTO is, in many ways, and I think other Thelemic communities as well, are sort of hamstrung by this problem, that they don't really have operating an organizational structure that matches their belief system. The other thing is that Quakers really believe in Quakerism. I mean, one of the more irritating things about the Quakers is their smugness and their spiritual superiority, which comes off oftentimes very subtly, which makes it even more obnoxious, and very powerfully. I mean, they really sincerely believe that Quakerism is the ultimate thing. And they don't say that. They're not going to come out and tell you that. They're not going to try to make you feel bad about it. But if you really know some Quakers, you know, that's really their opinion. And they can be very condescending, albeit in a liberal, progressive, nice way, towards people in other religions. My brother, for example, is a born-again Christian, and he finds the Quakers, like, completely annoying on that front, which, you know, I find funny and kind of ironic in a way. But regardless, I don't think the people in the OTO, for the most part, feel the same way about the Lima. I don't feel they trust it as a system the way the Quakers trust Quakerism. I think they have deep misgivings about the meanings of the Lima, deep dislike for Aleister Crowley. They don't like parts of the teachings. They don't like what they're reading. They've got, you know, inner conflicts and doubts and problems with it. And that just creates conflicts that boil over into the surface. And, you know, we're looking at why the leaders aren't producing that much. If the leaders are conflicted about the whole nature of what they're doing and feeling misgivings and doubts and hassles and problems about where their personal moral values conflict with the Lima, then how can they produce anything substantial?
Where do you think their values are coming from?
Well, I think they're coming from the secular world that, you know, we're living in. I mean, I think that the secular community, the secular humanism, the, you know, the basic standards of the way modern middle-class life runs informs the values of everybody within the culture. And, I mean, every single religion in America faces this problem. It's not unique to us. And you see some groups with a tension with the culture that exists, and there's some groups with no tension at all. And that's how you define the difference between a sect and a church. I mean, we talked about this before.
Right.
But I think that the OTO in particular, and the Thelema community in general, has a lot of time, a very hard time, addressing and engaging with the conflict or lack of conflict it has with the larger society. And that's because oftentimes our moral values are closer to the values of secular humanism than they are to, you know, what our own teachings are about.
Somebody might come back and say, look, the Quakers believe their religion. They have faith in their religion and their God and so forth. Thelema is not based on belief or theism or faith like that. It's based on, you know, practical being. It's based on empirical understanding. It's based on experimentation. So to say that people don't believe Thelema like Quakers believe their religion really isn't a fair comparison.
Well, I thought the difference was that we were Gnostics, that we aspired to knowledge, whereas the Quakers aspired to faith. And so basically, the Gnostic line has always been that Gnosis is superior to faith. I mean, for example, just a trivial example, you and I both know that water flows downhill, correct?
Yes.
Okay, in a natural environment, water flows downhill. We know this. We don't have to argue about it. We don't have to fight about it. We don't have to have internet flame wars about it. It's not an issue that we have to debate. 2 + 2 = 4. You know, 7 + 7 = 14. These are not things that we have to fight about. Real Gnostics have an understanding of the higher world, of truth, that really kind of exists on the same level. They know about it. They understand it. They don't have to fight about it. As Gnostics, we should be kind of better off than the Quakers are, who, you know, for the most part, have to deal with faith. Now, I'd like people to actually examine some criticisms of Protestantism that are advanced by Roman Catholics, who say that Protestantism is itself a Gnostic religion because it insists on an individual experience with the divine. In primitive, Protestantism, you have to have a personal relationship with Jesus. That personal relationship, for the Catholics, oftentimes is a Gnostic relationship. That's what Protestantism's error is to them, is that it's too Gnostic. So comparing us to the Quakers, who believe that God speaks to them, and when they speak with what God is telling them, that there is that of God in every man is a Quaker belief, I think it sounds more like what a lot of people in the OTO really think than it doesn't. Now, I could be wrong, but I think if you lined up all the Quaker beliefs and threw them at the membership of the OTO, they'd be more in agreement with them than they wouldn't be. I mean, like, let's ask ourselves this. I mean, seriously, if you said to the people in the OTO, by and large, is one person superior to another person from a spiritual perspective, what would they say?
They would say no.
Well, then why do we have a spiritual hierarchy in the EGC and the OTO? Why isn't everyone a ninth degree then? You see the contradiction. Now, that's a basic contradiction. Now, are the people in the OTO struggling with it and trying to resolve it, or are they just hoping it'll go away or work itself out somehow?
Well,
that's what I'm talking about, John. That's the contradiction.
Right. Often they'll come back and say, well, you know, those higher degrees are not necessarily spiritual degrees. They're service degrees. You know, it's all about service.
Well, yeah, then why are they... why are they imbued with all mystical stuff and the theurgy and thaumaturgy of their grade and everything else? That's not the way Crowley describes them. He doesn't say, oh, they're meaningless and everyone's equal and these are just, you know, administrative degrees that you go and do. Does he describe them that way?
No.
I may be missing something, but I see, you know, the sovereign sanctuary of the Gnosis. I see the thaumaturgy and theurgy of their grades. You know, I hear a whole different line coming from Crowley about that.
What are some of the other contradictions that you see?
Well, you know, basically, it comes down to, you know, beliefs in democracy. This is like a big issue. Where does legitimacy in government come from? In America, legitimacy comes from the consent of the governed through a democratic process. Now, if the majority of people do not support the government, and it's there anyway, then it lacks legitimacy. If it loses an election and is still in power, then it's not a legitimate government. This is the way we view legitimate hierarchy. That's not the way the OTO is set up. It's not set up that way at all. It's set up from a hierarchy where the majority of the people in the organization could be opposed to the decisions that are being made by the governing part of it, and that would be too bad. There's no election. You know, there's no the OTO does not need to be governed with the constant support of people that are not at a certain level of initiation. That basic legitimacy issue is at the heart of a lot of people's conflict with the order. And I don't see the OTO working to address it meaningfully. I don't see the members examining it or engaging in it meaningfully. And I don't see the leaders sitting down with people and saying, look, I know you feel this is a problem, but this is why it is the way it is, and this is why it's a good thing and not a bad thing. And this is why we're going to go through with it. I mean, that's the kind of leadership I expect from them. And instead, they kind of feel like, yeah, you know, I don't know. I know you feel that way, but Crowley set it up this way, and you know, the vigor and the support for the system as it is just isn't there. And consequently, the organization loses seriousness. It looks silly. How can leaders lead an organization whose legitimacy they themselves question and don't really strongly believe in or understand?
No, I think that's a very good question. And
I mean, do our leaders look? I think everyone in the Thelema community, regardless of what group you're in, needs to ask themselves, do our leaders really support the system as it is that they are running? Do they really support it? And if they did, would they behave the way they do? Would we see the articles they write? Would we see the actions and decisions they make? I mean, this is an important question. And if you think, yeah, they really do believe in it, they really do believe in the system, they really have a deep understanding of it, they support it as it is, and they don't have conflicts between their democratic, secular, humanistic worldviews and Thelema, then that's great. If you really believe that's the case, that's fine for you. I don't think it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've seen people who really, really, really are down with their system, and those are the Quakers that I know. You know, they're irritated by their fellow Quakers at times, they get frustrated with it, but they're really, really down with Quakerism. The people in the OTO, especially the people running it, are not down with Thelema and the OTO the same way Quakers are down with Quakerism. They just aren't.
No, and you and I have had conversations that, you know, I've also seen other religious communities, such as the Buddhist communities, that are down with their Buddhism and are willing to sacrifice almost anything. And yet the parallels in Thelema are just not there.
Right. Now, you know, a lot of times people try to make this, as I think you were suggesting, into a virtue. You know, that just means that we're better. Because we're not, you know, lockstep believers, and we're not, you know, robots, or we're not brainwashed, right? It's not a cult. It can't be a cult because everyone doesn't like it enough. If they liked it more, then it might be a cult. So it's good that people don't really like it that much. I mean, are those legitimate points? Or is that just, like, people covering up the fact that they're conflicted and aren't working on resolving the conflict?
I think that's a good question and a good place to stop for this episode. And maybe on the next one, we'll pick up from here and continue examining this conflict and, you know, look at some other aspects of the community. So
okay.
I appreciate you being on this podcast, and
well,
I'll talk to you soon.
Well, I appreciate you having me. Okay.
Thanks, Keith.
No problem.
This brings us to the end of this podcast. Again, I want to thank the people who email, IM, Skype, and post on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. I will be answering a good amount of the questions in the next podcast, so please keep listening. And keep the comments coming. Also, thanks to those who talk about the podcast on forums, their blogs, or link to it on their websites. This does make a difference, and I can see the traffic on the site reports. Please keep up the discussion and let others know about the podcast. The closing music is a song called Burning Hearts by the band Nuit. I hope you enjoy it. Love's the law, love under will.
Sometimes it appears that we're reaching a period when our senses and our minds will no longer respond to moderate stimulation. We seem to be approaching an age of the gross. Persuasion through speeches and books is too often discarded for instructive demonstrations aimed at bludgeoning the unconvinced into action.
Give up.